Welcome back to All This Math. This is Professor Parker, and today we're going to work with additions of mixed numbers. Addition of mixed numbers. So take a moment, pause the video if you need to, and copy down this problem.
Welcome to All This Math. This is Professor Parker, back at it again, and today we're going to talk about how to find the equation of a circle when you're given some information about the circle. Welcome back to All This Math. This is Professor Parker, in the flesh. We out here. We are multiplying rational expressions today. Today we are multiplying rational expressions. All right. Welcome back to All This Math. This is Professor Parker, and today we're going to get into a little bit of order of operations. Order of operations. All right. I'm going to take it slow. I'm going to go step by step. And as you see, I got my order of operations for you. You know what I mean? Please excuse my dear Aunt Sally. A lot of us learned that when we were younger. Welcome back to All This Math. This is Professor Parker, and today we're doing some work with addition of mixed numbers. The addition of mixed numbers. So take a moment. Pause the video if you need to, and copy down this problem into your notes.
Welcome to All This Math. This is Professor Parker, back at it again. And today, we're going to talk about how to find the equation of a circle when you're given some information about the circle.
Welcome back to All This Math. This is Professor Parker, in the flesh. We out here. We are multiplying rational expressions today. Today, we are multiplying rational expressions.
All right. Welcome back to All This Math. This is Professor Parker, and today we're going to get into a little bit of order of operations. Order of operations. All right? I'm going to take it slow, and I'm going to go step by step. And as you see, I got my order of operations hoodie on. You know what I mean? Please excuse my dear Aunt Sally. A lot of us learned that when we were younger. But the problem...
Hello?
Peace and blessings, family. We are working out a little technical difficulty. So we will be with you shortly. Just maintain.
Okay. No problem.
All right. Excellent.
Peace. Black power, black love that we are experiencing right now, but we are getting it together. This is Brother Patrick. Tonight, Sister Crystal will be the host tonight with our special guest, Brother Akil Parker of All That Math will be our special guest tonight. But I'll go ahead on and start it out since we are having the technical difficulties that we are. Brother Akil, are you there? I can hear you well, brother. Peace and blessings. Okay.
Peace.
So Brother Akil is on tonight. Yes, sir. Peace and blessings, brother. And we trying to get Crystal on. But let us go ahead on and open up and get started. And Crystal will let us know once she's on so that she can conduct the logistics of this podcast tonight. But we have with us tonight a very distinguished guest, my brother from Philly, my brother Akil Parker. Can't hear you. We trying to. So we trying to get this together. But yes, we have Brother Akil Parker, and Brother Akil has a superpower. I like to call it a superpower because I look at this allegiance of black liberation brothers and sisters as a super team. And all of us have our special skills. And Brother Akil has a very special skill in that he's an expert math teacher. And I have heard a lot of Brother Akil's commentary on different shows that he sent me links, and I listened to him. And the brother has a very profound and astute understanding of our situation and our children's need. So without further ado, I am kind of off guard right now. Let's hear from Brother Akil for a brief second while we get Crystal together. Brother Akil, how you doing today, brother?
I'm doing good. I'm doing good, brother. You know, I appreciate the introduction, and I'm glad we, you know, I haven't been able to get down to Mississippi to the conference yet. I look forward to doing that in the future. And you know, with the work I'm doing with mathematics and with the teaching and trying to, you know, talk to young people about, you know, establishing, you know, independent spaces for where black people can be human. You know, I'm trying to be like you, man. I see you down there, like growing food, you know, feeding the people, and not only that, but showing actual example of what it looks like to be self-sufficient, you know, in that way.
Yes,
and,
sir.
Yes, you know, sir. So that I admire that. I want to shout. I want to give you your props for that. Because a lot of times we talk about those things. And they're theoretical, and that's cool. That's cool. Some things have to be theoretical at first, but then we have to figure out ways to combine the theory with the practice. And, I see y'all down there as collectives, you know, combining the theory with the practice, you know, and that's what, you know, we have, you know, ancestors like, you know, Amilcar Cabral, you know, who was out there fighting against those damn Portuguese over in Guinea-Bissau, had a background in agricultural engineering. And he understood the value of the land, you know, and controlling the land, because once you control the land, just like Malcolm understood too, once you control the land, you can provide anything your people need, you know, because everything comes from the land, you know. So,
Yes, sir. Well, yes, sir. Brother Akil, I appreciate the accolades just as well. And, we will say that, brother. We did miss you with the summit. We were really reaching out and really hopeful. Ten one of the summits. I remember the first summit that we did 5 years ago. We reached out to a powerful brother up there that I'm sure you have locked arms with up there in the Elton Liberation in Philly, brother Professor Carl Tone Jones. And
oh, yeah.
That was one of the first brothers, yes, sir, that came and locked arms with us with our effort to applicate the theories of liberation. And that's our thing. You know, our whole thing with the Black Liberation Movement is to practically applicate the theories of our ancestors, the theories of our elders, the theories of our contemporaries. If we're not applicating, then they're no good unless they're applicating. So, you know, like I said, I like to think of all of us as having these individual superpowers. And, you know, Mississippi trying to control land and resources and build institutions and develop townships, we understand that it has to be some type of curriculum that goes along with that. We have to be an institution, brother, have teachers like yourself, teachers like Brother Professor Carl Tone, teachers like Crystal Denise and others across the country that we've been looking at. We have to be able to synchronize our efforts and reach out, you know, and make contact with brothers like yourself. So I'm so glad tonight, and I thought I was going to actually have the opportunity to sit back and just listen. But I'm so glad tonight that we have you on, brother. I think Crystal is really prepared for the day. She was ready. I talked with her earlier, and I'm just waiting on her to get on so that y'all can get on with
me. I'm on.
Okay.
Can y'all hear me?
She's on. She's on.
Yes,
we can hear you. We can hear you.
Okay. Greetings, family. Greetings. Greetings. As Brother Patrick said, you know, I'm excited about tonight. I've been, when Brother Akil told me that he could come on the 26th, I put it on my calendar. And what Brother Patrick said, well, Chris, I think you should lead it. Just because, and I'm excited, and I've been preparing, and I want to first pause and step back for a minute and just go back that we do when we open our sessions, libations and honoring our ancestors. And tonight I really want to do that because we are entering a time and space where we are forgetting who our ancestors are, who our elders are, what they stood for, whose shoulders we really stand on. And I think, and I know the discussion tonight is going to pull from some of those ancestors. So I want us to think about what it is that we're doing and why we're doing it. And I want us to reflect on that oath to the ancestors that Brother Patrick opens up with weekly, our ancestors that are blacker than a thousand midnights. Our African ancestors that we, your children, respect and give honor to. Our African ancestors who have been purposely excluded from the history books so that the world would not know of your greatness. Our African ancestors who gave civilization to the world. Let's think about the Mali Empire. Let's think about the Kingdom of Kush. Our African ancestors who gave the arts to the world. Let's think about people like Emmanuel Lewis and Alvin Ailey. Our who gave music to the world, jazz, blues, gospel. Our African ancestors who gave sciences to the world, George Washington Carver. Our African ancestors who gave mathematics to the world, Akil, that's your specialty, your superpower, mathematics. We have Mama Catherine Johnson and Mama Marjorie Lee Brown. Our African ancestors who gave medicine to the world, Dr. Patricia Babb and Rebecca Lee Crumpler. Our African ancestors who gave literature to the world, Richard Wright, Margaret Walker. Our African ancestors who gave philosophy to the world, Imhotep. Our African ancestors who gave God consciousness to the world. And that all still is within us. We don't know of our greatness, but when we figure it out, when we build our institutions, when we teach our greatness, we'll rise up, I say. Tonight I want to remember Fetty Jackson Coppin. And some time ago, I made a post about her because Coppin State University is named in her honor, but tonight it was significant to me because in 1865, she began teaching at an institute for colored youth. And in this institute, she taught Greek, Latin, mathematics, and she wanted to dispel the myth that people of African descent could not learn. She taught at this institute for 37 years, and she got married, and she and her husband, who was a missionary Baptist minister, traveled to South Africa and taught over there. And in 1904, the institution was moved to Cheney, Pennsylvania, and became Cheney State. So with that, I'm going to go into our special guest. Y'all heard his voice. Y'all heard Brother Patrick talk with him a little bit. And when I say Cheney State, that's significant because Akil Parker, let me read what he said, what I know as well. He's the founder and CEO of All This Math, an organization offering private math tutoring and educational consulting in the black community. All This Math was founded in 2017 and later became more of an active entity in 2018 after Akil left his full-time math teaching position in the school district of Philadelphia in order to build the organization as well as focus on college-level teaching. Prior to leaving the school district of Philadelphia, he had been teaching high school math since the spring of 2005 in a mixture of charter schools, public schools, and extracurricular programs. Brother Akil is currently an adjunct professor at Cheney University, where he teaches pure math as well as math education courses. Having been a two-time graduate of HBCUs, Morgan State, and Lincoln, he understands the value of supporting these institutions as an effort toward independent nation building for black people. In the evening, he also teaches in a night school program for adult learners of learning mathematics so that they will be able to assist their own children with developing their math skills. For Akil, mathematics education is directly connected to the teachings of Malcolm X and Pan-African nationalism, since it should be the responsibility of the community, to do everything for itself, including educating its own children. His work with All This Math and his formal teaching all speak to the achievement of these goals. He has a long-term goal of mathematics becoming viewed as useful and accessible problem-solving tool, as an accessible problem-solving tool for the black collective. And so, with that, I have witnessed this brother. I have heard this brother speak, and I am convinced that what Brother Patrick said at the beginning, that he understands what it is that the black community needs and has made it his mission to help provide that. So Brother Akil has written for our monthly newsletter, Wake Up, and the first article he wrote was It Starts in the Home. And so what I would like Brother Akil to do is expand on what that means as a parent and as an educator, the mantra that it starts at home, and what it is that we need to understand should be starting at home, Brother Akil.
Yes, yes. I'm hoping I could, live up to everybody's expectations.
I know you can.
I was listening to you read the bio, and I was like, oh, who's that guy? But anyway, in all seriousness, though, because we got to be serious, because these are serious issues. The essay, It Starts in the Home, it just came out of just some thoughts that I've been having for years about the concept and kind of like the catchphrase that a lot of us in the black collective, I'll say, like to use. Like whenever something goes wrong in the community, in the area where, black people of African descent, where we inhabit, and, especially if it's something that is, something that takes place that youth are responsible for, people are quick to point the finger and blame, the parents. It's really a cop-out. I look at it as a cop-out. In most cases, it's a cop-out because people don't want to be held responsible for anybody else's biological children. People don't want to be held responsible for anything that goes on within the community except for what may go on in their own household. And that's part of a culture. That's part of a Western culture. That's part of a Eurocentric mind, and like a part of a individualistic Eurocentric worldview. Whereas, like, kind of like this whole "I got mine, you got to get yours." What I eat don't make you shit. So mind your business. Whatever that whole thing that kind of has run rampant and is very, really very problematic. It sounds, a lot of those catchphrases, they sound empowering, but actually they cause much more harm than good. So when I was thinking about this, and that's why, I recommend writing to everybody, because one of the things I've learned from one of my elder scholars, Dr. Greg Carr, is that when you write, it's even better than the conversation. The conversation is good, and reading is good. Reading is excellent as well, but what writing does is it forces you to have like an internal dialogue with yourself. Because when you're writing, then you write a sentence down, you write words down, then you read what you wrote, and then you're constantly filtering and going back and forth with yourself about whether this idea really makes sense, or whether you're missing something, or if you're leaving something out, or if you need to add something to it. So I highly recommend writing down your thoughts and your ideas to everybody, because I know it's been very helpful for me. But as I was writing, you know, this, and I was thinking about the concept of it starts in the home, I was thinking about the fact that actually we probably should say that anything that happens in the community really is an outgrowth of what happens in the community institutions, because the community institutions are what kind of are what socializes everybody. No one is immune to community institutions. And even if you have like a tight-knit household, I would say, and within a tight-knit household, if there's a mother and a father in the household and they kind of are responsible for, you know, raising the children, at some point the children are going to go outside the household. They're going to go to a school. Mm-hmm. They're going to go to a recreation center. They're going to go to maybe a religious institution. They're going to walk to the corner store. They're going to go different places. So they still will be influenced by the energy of the people outside, the institutions outside, the people outside. You know, they're still going to be in influenced by that. So I was thinking a lot about community institutions, and I'm also reminded when I was writing this of the late Dr. Bobby Wright. And one of the things he said in one of his lectures was, you know, the issue that we have is that as black people, we have the people, but they have the institutions. So meaning like basically the white people control the institutions, but, you know, black people, we live in like these like majority, a lot of times it's majority black, you know, communities and collectives and, you know, 99%, 98%, 100% black folks. But all the institutions that are responsible for socializing us are not controlled by us. They're controlled by other people, outsiders, and actually people that are adversarial to us. So that's a very problematic situation in and of itself. So when we look at the behavior, it's easy for people to say, you know, oh, it starts in the home, you know, and kind of they also kind of end up indemnifying those community institutions that really benefit, you know, from, you know, the kind of the dysfunction that we see in our community many times. You know, we gotta always think about that Latin phrase, cui bono, meaning who benefits. In any situation, we have to do a proper analysis. And again, this is like a mathematical approach, a proper analysis, because oftentimes when something bad happens, I was having this conversation with my wife about this the other day. There's an objective value and there's a subjective value. So, you know, like when we think about, you know, negative and positive, like in mathematics, negative doesn't really mean something is bad per se or something is unfavorable per se. It really just means the opposite, right? So if you have like, you know, positive 8, you know, the negative of positive 8 is negative 8. It just means take the opposite of positive 8. Just like if you had negative 8, you would take the opposite. The negative of negative 8 is positive 8. It really just means, you know, take the opposite. So these are we got to also look at both sides of the equation. Like, okay, so this is something that looks negative. It's negative that this, you know, these drugs are being sold in the community, right? It's negative if there was a shootout and, you know, a young child might have got caught in a crossfire. That's negative, but everything is not all bad and everything is not all good. Someone or some entity is benefiting at the same time. And oftentimes we only focus on the negative and who's being harmed, and we don't look at, okay, well, who is it that is maintaining this scenario or maintaining this circumstance? Who's profiting from this, especially when we consider we live in a monopoly capitalistic economic system, right, which privileges profit in terms of financial reward and financial gain over the value of just human life anyway. So, you know, it's like, okay, well, if we can make a profit off of, you know, black people killing each other, then we're going to create the conditions and help to maintain and facilitate the conditions so that that will happen. That's what we're going to do. And so this is like a deeper level analysis that a lot of our ancestors have already done. So we don't really have to do much of the analysis on our own. We just need to read the books and just expose ourselves to this way of thinking. But oftentimes, most of our people, we're not conditioned to even think that way and think that deeply, which is another reason why I'm a heavy advocate for mathematics, because what mathematics does is it forces and trains your brain to be, you know, to be conditioned for critical analysis and critical thinking at all times. But, you know, we're not used to doing that. So we kind of deal in these like superficial, you know, 30-second soundbite type of commentaries, and we say things like, well, you know, it starts in the home. You know, if black parents,
let me ask you this.
Everything would be fine.
As an educator, because I noticed, you know, I've had this conversation before, and one thing that I remember saying was we used to say it takes a village. Now we're saying it starts in the home, and I think a lot of people don't even understand what that it is. And in the article, you talked a lot about a community doing the teaching, and that the home should be the learning place, and school should be where you practice your learning and study your enemy. And a lot of times when we say it, what is that it that we're talking about? Is it somebody else's definition of it, or do we just say it because it sounds good and it makes us think that we're better than the next parent whose child isn't doing whatever they're supposed to be doing? I mean, I would like for you as an educator to kind of elaborate on that, what that it is that we speak of, and that we and then kind of segue and lead us into a discussion of how the community is supposed to be defining it, if you will. If that makes sense as my question.
Yeah, I think the it is anything and everything. I think it's all encompassing. Mm-hmm. I think whenever something happens, and typically it's usually something that's perceived as when we make the value judgment on whether something is good or bad, it is something negative. Because, you know, a lot of times when something positive happens, people aren't as – I mean, some people are, but people aren't as vehement with saying, okay, you know, your child is, you know, excelling, and, you know, your child, you know, is building, helping to build the community up. They kind of just look at that as like, oh, okay, that's cool, right? But when something harmful happens, then it's like, you know, we gotta attack this household. You know,
mm-hmm.
We gotta attack it. And at the same time, it's not to say that, you know, everybody's household is perfect and that there is not room for critique of many households, because it is. But one of the things I'm advocating for is us to sort of think more in terms of a collective mindset and consider that household where those harmful things are taking place as part of a larger community, so that therefore people would take more responsibility instead of kind of have like a generally condescending attitude and outlook.
Uh-huh.
And say, well,
uh-huh.
I got my house in order, y'all got to get y'all house in order, you know. Because,
uh-huh.
you know, I've also thought about this too, and I wrote an essay about this. I wrote an essay some years back called It's My Fault. And what I was thinking about, it was like the culmination of a lot of thoughts where, you know, oftentimes, like, everything is not your fault, right? But
mm-hmm.
I was kind of thinking in terms of what would the communities, the neighborhoods, and the collective be like if everything that happened in the black community, everybody said, oh, that's my fault that happened. You know, like,
mm-hmm.
does something harmful in the community, and then, you know, an elder or a grown man or a brother that's a little older than him finds out about it. He's like, damn, you know, that's my fault. I shouldn't have. I could have did something to influence him in a certain way. And then what if, like, everybody just had that mentality and had that outlook? How would that affect the culture of the community and the culture of that collective? How would it affect it? Because then people would be – we would experience this cognitive dissonance and this discomfort, this internal personal discomfort, whereas we feel inextricably linked to the welfare and the well-being of the entire collective. So then we will be forced into action. We will be forced to do things differently instead of where it kind of is set up now, where we're not forced into action. We kind of just want to kind of insulate ourselves. Many of
mm-hmm.
us want to just insulate ourselves and kind of protect ourselves from the so-called, quote-unquote, bad Negroes, right? We want
mm-hmm.
to kind of just like figure out ways to try to stay away from them, right? And, you know, in all honesty, you know, since we're talking about reality, I mean, sometimes you might need to do, you definitely need to identify, okay, who is parasitic and who is problematic in the community. And maybe we do need to draw some lines. But when we're talking about children, and then we're talking about like long-term effects, we could also say, you know, well, this, how could I contribute to a difference, right, in this situation? So I was thinking about, you know, what if, you know, we just tried to find ways to say, you know, how we're accountable, like how are we responsible?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would often think about times when, you know, I look at the community. And I look at, like, you know, young brothers, you know, in Philly, you know, shooting at each other and whatnot. And I think back into, you know, my 20s. And I'm only one person, but still, at the same time, you know, I remember, you know, a lot of my time spent in my 20s, you know, just, you know, working, you know. And I was teaching, but I wasn't really teaching, like, really for the people. I was really teaching just to, you know, I needed
mm-hmm.
a job.
That's what we all do. Most
food, clothes, shelter. Mm-hmm. I wasn't thinking in terms of building the community. I wasn't thinking really in terms
mm-hmm.
of, like, black nationalism, like, at least not early on, not as early on. I kind of grew into that on a certain trajectory. But, you know, a lot of my time was spent hanging out, partying, going out, getting drunk. And, you know, I wasn't, like, even thinking about building institutions, like, for the community and for the people. And then I think back, and I'm like, wow, like, what if I had been focused on that, like, in my 20s? You know,
mm-hmm.
Instead
mm-hmm.
of being out here like, in the streets and in the bars and in the clubs, like chasing women, you know, and you know, doing this and that, wasting money and resources on, you know, designer brand clothes and, you know, trying
mm-hmm.
to be, you know, gain the material trappings of, you know, of white definitions of success. Like, what if I'd have been doing some different things? Like, because then it's like years later, you know, in these same neighborhoods, you know, those institutions are not created by the adults that were in position to create them, then, you know, the community is going to suffer because then we haven't built up those young people. And again, in the absence of those institutions, a lot of people just look back at the parents and just say, well, it's the parents' fault. But then we don't know all the
mm-hmm.
details and the specifics of the situations that the parents are dealing with, you know, how many jobs they're working, like maybe somebody was incarcerated, maybe somebody – you know, just maybe they just weren't good parents. But again, like you mentioned, if we have the village mentality and the village mindset, then that should compensate for poor parenting. Because I don't think it
right.
should be, well, okay, these children are not going to get what they need because the two individuals, the mother and the father, are just not good parents. And a lot of kids,
right,
a lot of
and
kids
see,
that's what
and
to
see,
deal with.
Right, and I'm fortunate to be of a hello. Oh, I'm
yeah.
just saying, I'm fortunate to be of an age where I remember a community, a village mentality where you, what you did reflect the community because we had this thing that it's not my business and what goes on this house stays in this house. What goes on in your house does not stay in your house. It's going to affect somebody else one way or the other, whether it be something positive or what you say negative. But so, you know, that mentality, until we take control of our education, I think is going to persist. You said you came into what you're doing. You know, when you first started out, I think most of us, when we first start out, we just want that job. You know, we just want to, you know, provide the basic necessities of life, as you said. And we all,
mm-hmm.
and that's my frustration is that until we have to build institutions because it's always going to be that way. You know, I came into the knowledge in my 40s. What if I had come into it in my 20s? You know, would there be a Shea Academy here in Arkansas? If we know in different places across the country, if we were all gaining that knowledge and understanding who we are at the foundational level and who, and that what we do as John Henry, Dr. John Henry Carr said, do for your people, take your best and do for your people. If we
mm-hmm.
all had that mentality at that age where, you know, once you graduated or whatever, you knew what you were going to do for your people, how you were going to do it for your people, where you were going to do it for your people. So until we start really thinking about serious institution building, I think, you know, we can philosophize and project all day, But until we start building something to actually put that into action, I think a lot of us are going to be, you know, having the same experiences through future generations. So, yeah, I feel you when you say that. I was also looking at this article, and you and I like how you connect everything back to math, because the way you feel about math is the way I feel about reading. You know, Marcus Garvey said, a reading man and woman is ready, man and woman, but a writing man and woman is exact. And so when you were talking about writing, it reminded me of that quote by the Honorable Marcus Messiah Garvey. But I feel like reading helps us think and imagine and figure things out in our mind, and mathematics takes it a step further. And I think math is our thing, and we just let people complicate it. So I would like for you to speak to that, because I heard you speak a couple weeks ago, and you were talking to the brother about survival mathematics. And I want you to talk a little bit about that and how we need to go beyond thinking about it and think about how it affects us daily and at the bottom line, and why it's so important that we do understand math and how we do use it every day. Most people think they don't, and why we have that math phobia.
Well, oftentimes when I get to this part of the conversation, I often end up, you know, evoking another ancestor, the late Dr. Andrew Wilson. You know, one of the things that he, you know, discussed was the fact that, you know, we have to be honest and clear that the fact that there's a political necessity for black children to not excel in mathematics. Mathematics, like some other disciplines, is a tool for nation building. Because when we're talking about building a nation, we're talking about maintaining the nation. Even if we lower our focus, right? You know, like, you know, sometimes when we say nation building, depending upon who's listening, it sounds like this whole like pie in the sky like thing, like this whole weird, like, you know, romantic, you know, Wakanda, Black Panther type thing, right? So even if we talk about like in your own household, right, mathematics is needed to maintain a household successfully. You know, there's budgeting concerns, there's financial concerns, there's, you know, you have to budget food, you know, there's clothing for children, for adults, like how is this going to get paid, how is that going to get paid, how are we planning for our future, how we, you know, just different types of things. I mean, even if you want to, like, you know, do some interior design work in your home, you know, all these things have to be maintained. Now, when we scale that up, when we start talking about, like, you know, independent nation building, now it's like, well, in the household, you can just turn the water faucet on. As long as you paid the water bill, the water's going to come out the faucet. But now we're talking about, okay, now we have to have infrastructure built so that way we make sure all the households in our community and in our nation can get clean running water, right? We have to have, like, you know, the work like what that Brother Patrick is doing, like with the food. We got to have the farming done, right? We got to have the farming done. We got to use mathematics to, you know, navigate through all of that. We have to be able to have distribution networks for the food that we grow, and make sure that people get to it. If we're going to process the food to make certain types of meals, you know, we got to have that. We got to be able to calculate and quantify everything. So, you know, you're always going to need mathematics whenever you're dealing with more than one of something. If we only have one of something, then you don't need math. But then you're still going to need math, because if you have one of eight different things, that's still more than one. That's eight things, right? But now, you know, you might have 58 of this thing and 6,000 of this thing and 3,000 of this thing and 24 of this thing and just all these different moving parts and all these variables. And there's when you just look at it, especially as an educator, you know, working in the schools, then you just kind of look and you're just like, there's been a long time, you know, marketing push and public relations push for math to be made to be uncomfortable for so many people. I think it transcends, you know, racial group, but I'm really only concerned about our racial group right now anyway.
Right.
So I'm concerned about the other racial groups, but in terms of, like, you know, teaching our children, we have to be responsible for our children. So we focus in on them. So that marketing mm-hmm. has definitely affected directly, you know, our children to the point where we're really scared of mathematics. You know, mathematics is like a bully, you know. And I can even attest to that. And one of the things I like to say in these conversations is that, because some people feel discouraged about, you know, trying to learn mathematics, and then they see people that excel at mathematics, and then part of the marketing is also that people that excel in mathematics were born that way, so to speak. And I don't believe that to be true. I think myself as an example, I pretty much did well in mathematics for the majority of my schooling from kindergarten through 12th grade. And then I had to take my math coursework in undergrad and whatnot. But there were some moments where, you know, I didn't really get it right away. A lot of stuff I didn't get right away. Like, I had classmates that mm-hmm. that didn't really have to study a lot. You know, that was them.
Right.
That was, you know, their you know, how they received information. For me, I was the person, I had to work hard. I had to go home and do the homework every night, you know, and make sure that I until I understood the process and I understood the formulas and I understood how they get broken down and whatnot. So I think it's important for people to hear that too, because, you know, even like they might see me on a YouTube channel and, you know, it seems so effortless and whatnot, but it's like, but I'm like, listen, it wasn't always like that, you know. And I think that's one of the things that propels me and motivates me to tutor and to help other people, is because I know how that feels. Like, that's an emotional thing. And I think a lot of people, they have this, you know, studying mathematics and these experiences in math classes and, you know, sitting at home, you know, in front of a math textbook and just not knowing how to do the work. There's an emotional response to that, and it doesn't always feel good. And I know that feeling, and I want to try to help our people, as, you know, as many as I can, not have to experience that feeling. So then, you know, math can, like I said in the bio, math can become an accessible and helpful tool as opposed to being something that we avoid in any way possible and try to mm-hmm. evade, right? Because we don't know what you don't know. A lot of people, you know, they lose all types of, they lose large amounts of money. They, you mm-hmm. know, go into deals and situations, you know, where they don't really understand the finances. They don't understand the calculations. They don't understand the percentages. They don't understand what they're signing up for. And a lot of these businesses and corporations, again, because we're dealing with monopoly capitalism, which privileges financial gain over humanity and human worth. So, you know, people have their bottom lines and they're trying to maintain an increased profit margin. So these people will smile in your face and shake your hand while they're mm-hmm. robbing you. Rob you without a gun. You know?
Right. One thing you said in that other interview is now, and I noticed it myself, when you go to the car lot, they don't give you a price. They ask you how much you can afford a month. And we think that is a great thing, right? Oh, and they'll work out the terms for you to pay, you know, probably three times more than the car is really worth. And so just not having the basic skill of negotiating, because we think we're negotiating, right? But we're really not, because they're adding everything into that price. And that's just, you know, one example I heard you speak about, but I know there are probably a lot of others that, you know, we think we're getting a deal, but they actually have padded it or made some kind of adjustment to where we're actually paying more than, way more than we should. So, yeah.
They may spread the payments out over a longer period of time. So, like, you're taking a longer time to pay back the total loan. So it's like, you know, it's like the whole thing. Like, as long as I owe you, you'll never go broke, you know. So mm-hmm. they're going to get those in. And, like, you know, we look at it as, I mean, when you really understand, you know, finance, you know, there is a such thing as debt financing and debt leveraging, but that's not what most people are doing. Most people are just taking all these predatory loans out of desperation.
Mm-hmm.
And you got people that are seen as, you know, influencers in the black community that, you know, are doing commercials for these car dealerships, and, you know, poor black people grew up, you know, and listening to their music. They see them in these commercials, you know, promoting these car dealerships, and it's like, you know, they're bringing them in so that they can get fleeced, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I don't even know if some of these guys really know the math behind what's going on. But all they know is they're getting a check. So it's like,
right,
okay, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. But again, you can't defend yourself, you know. And a lot of young people, they've been taught, you know, like, you know, we got all these, like I said, there's a lot of catchphrases. Like, it starts in the home is a catchphrase, and
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
we, you know, it's a lot of catchphrases. Like, all I need to know how to do is count my money. That's another one. That's another one that's
mm-hmm.
very. It's very toxic. All I need to know is count my money.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the problem with that is you want to be able to make sure that the amount of money that you're counting is the appropriate amount of money. And
right.
you often have no way of knowing, you know, if this person, like, are your hours straight? Like, oh, you
mm-hmm.
You worked overtime. That's time and a half. Or is it double time?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and how many
mm-hmm.
how many hours are overtime? How many hours are double time? How many hours are straight time? Like, you know, what's it supposed to add up to? You know, what about your taxes? Are the proper amount of taxes being taken out? Is that percentage right? Do you even know how to calculate that? Can you deduct that from? And then, you know, because we live in a society where we can't trust. We're in so many situations where we can't trust people. We just can't. So, and what happens is the people that will exploit you, they will look selectively and try to find and pinpoint and identify the people that they can try it with, you know, that they can get over on. So they
mm-hmm.
know they can get over on, or who they think they
mm-hmm.
can get over on, and then they know they can't. So they'll try certain things with certain people, and if you get identified as one of those people because they know you don't know the math,
right?
You know, then you know that's a problem. And again, when you go to the it's a larger issue because when we deal with the school systems. This country is built on that. Like, this country is built on
mm-hmm.
exploitation
mm-hmm.
and stuff. You know,
mm-hmm.
so it's like, you know, it's not a fair situation. It never was fair. It was never meant to be fair. I mean, we're on stolen land right now. You know, so
right.
So the school system is going to maintain the circumstance where those that are in certain power and in certain positions will be able to continue to steal in certain ways.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not going to be educated. In those spaces, generally. Now, there might be some individual people that kind of, you know, are like what we might consider a glitch in the matrix, like this teacher
mm-hmm.
over here or that teacher. They might try to put you on and let you know, okay, listen, you know, I'm going to teach you what you really need to know, but you got to make sure you pay attention so that you can protect
right.
yourself out of it. But
right.
generally speaking, that teacher is an anomaly. And, you know, the overall overarching system doesn't want you to know how to protect yourself, because then this system implodes, and it thrives off of exploitation. But once you give people the proper
right.
education, so that you know they can protect themselves from being exploited, now you've lost a lot of your customer base.
Mm-hmm. Right,
you
and
know?
That's why, you know, when people say, well, they need to teach financial literacy in class, well, do they? I mean, really, when you understand racism, what it is and how it works, you know that's not going to happen. But you said something that reminded me of a question I wanted to ask about Common Core. Do you know, the argument is that it enhances critical thinking skills. How do you feel about that?
Now, whether it's actually happening, I don't know. I don't know if it's actually happening, because again, that's something that may differ from classroom to classroom. I do know that I know there are a lot of complaints about it, but when I started teaching at Cheney, and actually before teaching at Cheney, so first I was teaching at LaSalle University, right, small little liberal arts college here in Philly. Now I'm teaching at Cheney, and I was teaching a math education course at LaSalle. Now I'm teaching basically a similar math education course, a part one and a part two at Cheney. And so that gave me the opportunity to really get into, you know, what is this, like, this Common Core stuff that, you know, all these parents are complaining about, and, you know, people, when they say that they talk about this quote-unquote new math, like, what really is this? What is this that they're
mm-hmm.
talking about? I didn't know, because, like, my classroom experience has always been on the high school level.
Okay.
My only real experience with, I guess, the elementary level, it might have been helping, you know, my oldest son, Nassim, when he was younger with some of his work, or, you know, helping, you know, my daughter, Asada, with some of her homework, you know, when she was, like, younger, like in preschool or in kindergarten. So But you know, looking at it like as an educator charged with teaching teachers how to teach it, what I realized was it kind of, again, I think they're useful tools, because what happens is like 30 years ago, 30 plus years ago actually, when I was learning how to do long division, there was one way to do division. It was long division. This is how you do it. And then once you learn that, you go on to another topic. But now there's like all these different methods they're teaching. They're teaching like the box method. They're teaching like partial quotient method. And it's even, matter of fact, I did a video on the All This Math YouTube channel about comedic multiplication. There's also a comedic division method, which that's really important. I don't think these schools are teaching that. And I don't expect them to, because if they start teaching that, what they got to do is give acknowledgement to ancient Africa. And these school districts don't want to do that, because unless they lie and say, well, you know, the Greeks that actually, which some of these school systems do that, and some Europeans do this, they promote this lie that Europeans or Greeks went to Egypt or went to ancient Kemet and taught our ancestors, and then that's how they learned it, and then, you know, whatever. And again, I'm fine with that. I don't really fight against that much these days, because I'm like, all I know is if white people want to lie to their children, that's on them. You know, I just think we should be able to tell our children the truth, you know.
Right.
I don't really get into that whole – I don't want to use energy at this stage on trying to prove, like, you know, who did what and who did it first and, you know, whatever. But, yeah, there's just a lot of different, like, methods of, like, doing division, for example. And, you know, what I tell, like, you know, my students at Cheney, you want to be armed with a lot of different methods of doing one type of thing, because some students may catch on more quickly or be more comfortable with a certain type of method. You know, like with anything, like, you know, it's good to have options, you know, sometimes. Sometimes it's good to have options. Mm-hmm. Sometimes options complicate things. But if you, like with division, we were talking about division, so we got like comedic division, partial quotients, the box method, the traditional long division algorithm. So that's four different methods of doing division. So let's say different students in your class might naturally gravitate toward a different method. Now they have options. And also, like, learning all of them gets you to get a better conceptual understanding of mathematics generally. You know, it's kind of like with reading. Like, you know, you read different types of books, read books from different authors. You might read about a topic, different people from different perspectives are talking about it from. So you get to, like, understand, like, the topic even better, because you're reading about the opinions and the views of different people that are talking about the same thing. So it gives you a richer and a fuller understanding. So math is really, the math topics are really the same way. So I think Common Core, it can be used strategically. I just think that, you know, well, we should be teaching our own children anyway. And there are a lot of valuable tools in these school systems. I do think sometimes we do tend to throw the baby out with the bathwater, and we use a lot of the tools that they have there that we could be using to benefit from, right? And I've had to reflect on this myself, because I know I've done that in the past, you know. Especially
well, I heard
like
someone space. Say,
well, go ahead.
You know, with the Common Core placement, you know, is getting your mind trained for computer coding. And because, you know, with this technology age that we're in, it's just training our children to think in that way. That's what the training is, thinking in that way and how their mind can be used to benefit. Of course, white supremacy, everything that they do is for that benefit. So, you know, because I struggle with it. I remember when we used to go over in part of Senatobia, Newtown, over in the housing authority, over in the projects and health, we wanted to do some cultural programs, but we spent so much of our time helping do homework, and it was real frustrating because my children, you know, are older, and so, you know, that's one of my concerns with my granddaughter is when she starts this math, am I going to be able to help her? Because, like you said, there are different ways to teach math, but what I've experienced with it is that they want it shown one way, and you have to show your, quote, art, or they count off if it's not the way that they've been teaching. And so, that you know, that concerns me as well. But I want to pause for a minute because I do want to give out the number for people if they want to call in to add to the discussion. The number is 563-999-3682. 563-999-3682. And when you're on, you can just press 1 if you would like to speak or comment or ask Professor Akil a question about what we're talking about tonight. So I just wanted to put that in there. But, yeah, that Common Core, you know, I can see the benefits, but I can see more harm because a lot of parents don't know how to help their children. And then that goes back to, if they don't, it goes back to the whole, well, it starts in the home kind of thing, you know.
Right.
Well, you got to help your children with your homework. Well, how the hell can I help them? I don't understand how to do it. So, you know,
right.
It just creates a multitude of issues.
So this is, you
yeah.
know, speaking to that point, this is one of the things that I thought about in a kind of, it crystallized for me, like, in the last, you know, couple of months that, you know, one of the things that I want to be able to offer to our community with all this math is, you know, is the YouTube channel. You know, for now, it's, you know, it's a YouTube channel. I may, you know, in the future create my own separate website with video content because a lot of the video content that's available in terms of math instruction is really aimed at the students. And it's really, a lot of it is really for, I mean, it's created by teachers like myself. It's created by teachers, and like a lot of times teachers will use it to supplement their lessons so the students can, you know, get the video support, which is a great idea. But it's not, oftentimes it doesn't seem like it's catered toward the parents. So what I realize is that, you know, a lot of times, like, you know, parents should be able to, should be empowered to help, be able to help their children, you know, with their homework. So one of the things I'm doing more of is creating content that, you know, parents will be able to benefit from, you know, because I'm sure there's like, because again, that's something that I take for granted. I have no anxiety at all about, you know, due to my position and what I study and what I do, that when any of my children come home and, you know, say, you know, Dad, I don't know how to do this, I can just help them. Like, all right, cool. Like, you know, let me show you, let me see what you got. You know, I'll break
mm-hmm.
it down for you. But everybody's mm-hmm. not like it. Everybody doesn't have that luxury. That's a luxury, baby.
Right, right.
It could be a luxury. But in the current society we live in, mathematical, high-level mathematical competency is a luxury. We have to accept
mm-hmm.
that reality. One of my goals is for it not to be a luxury. It's for it to become democratized and available to all of our people. Now, everybody's not going to take it, but it at least should be available and accessible, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that means parents. Like I mentioned, like, you know, with night school, I'm teaching adult learners that previously had to separate or drop out of the school district of Philadelphia at some point. So they're like, you know, some 20-year-olds, 30-year-olds, 40-year-olds, 50-year-olds, even older than that, that are in the process of taking coursework in order to get their diplomas. And one of the things I stress to them is like, you know, yeah, getting your diploma is cool. But what I really want y'all to be able to do is just something very fundamental and basic, but very profound, is be able to help your children, your grandchildren, your nieces, your nephews, be able to help them with their homework. You know, because I wonder, if we sit back and think about it, like how often a child comes home with the homework, you don't know, you, they show it to you, you don't know how to do it, that would create frustration. It would create a lot of
mm-hmm.
frustration.
Yeah.
And that doesn't necessarily have to be there because I think, well, the schools aren't really actively trying to educate the parents. They kind of, I think generally society has this idea that, you know, well, you should have learned it when you was in school. And,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
we don't have, you know, sensitivity to the fact that, you know, there are a lot of things going on. There are a lot of, you know, impediments and hindrances in, you know, public school settings, charter school settings. And just sometimes it's not even an issue of things going up, impediments and hindrances in the school building, but sometimes in your own household. So maybe when they were
right.
a child 20 years or 30 years ago, they were prohibited from really being able to focus on learning. But whatever happened in the past, they should still be able to learn, you know. Like School District of Philadelphia as an example, they have a program called Parent University. I don't know how efficient or effective it is, I've never sat in any of the classes myself as a parent, or maybe I have. I can't really remember. I might have went to one of the meetings like maybe a few years back, but I don't know that they were really trying to do what I'm trying to do, which is like empower students and the parents and also the teachers, so the teachers can have some support for, you know, their lessons, because a lot of you have a lot of teachers that don't have a lot of experience, and you know, all teachers have been there when you didn't have a lot of experience and you were just starting out and you didn't really know what you were doing. You know, you kind of on the job training. So, you know, especially with a course like math, where there's already a lot going on in the classroom, and your back is already up against the wall because so many students already have been kind of imbued with this idea that they're not going to excel in this subject, and there's already this kind of this innate frustration. And then you, as the math teacher, you personify the subject, so then you receive a lot of that hostility from the child and from the student. So then you got to deal with that emotional aspect, right? So that video support, I think, would be even more helpful. And also what it speaks to is something else I talked about in the It Starts in the Home article is this paradigm shift that I'm really promoting. And I want us to even start thinking about is how, you know, even if we just start to think about the black household and the black community and the black collective becoming the primary the primary provider of education for our children, as opposed to where it is now, like, you know, I send you to school to get educated, and then you come home to deep. So it's like you go to school to get educated, and you come home to practice. But I think we should learn at home, even if it's not in the individual household, right? But if it's whether it's in your home or whether in your community or in your block or in your neighborhood, and then you go to school to practice. So then, because that lessens a lot of the issues that we have with school, because, you know, like, learning is a very vulnerable activity. And if I don't, as a student, if I'm looking at this teacher and I don't know this teacher, I don't trust this teacher, I might not like this teacher. And maybe he or she doesn't like me either. You know, we're even, right? It's going to be very difficult. It takes a very mature student to still learn from a person that you have that type of relationship with, or that you engage in that. And everybody.
Right. We have a caller. We got a caller.
Okay.
The last four, 6356. You're on. Question, comment. 6356. Last four. 6356.
Greetings, Mama Crystal.
Greetings. How you doing?
Yes. How are you all? Love the call.
How are you?
Definitely agree with everything. I can't even say nothing because I would just be repeating what y'all said. So I'm just going to say right. So I always have Mama Crystal say it right. You know, I agree completely. I'm there. I have four children, homeschooling for a bit. Math is not my favorite subject at all, but we go get there.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Well, you can go to his YouTube channel, and he's going to be giving out information about that as we continue on. But, and we all need to link up, because I will say this, when we started our shave, Brother Keel did reach out and say, y'all have anybody helping with the math part? Math program, like, no. And so we're gonna be talking about how we're gonna incorporate some of his lessons into the Ashe Academy. So, yeah, your children will definitely
wonderful.
Benefit.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you, gratitude, brother.
Brittany, thank you. Thanks for calling.
The thing
thank
is, it's like, you know, in our community, mathematics generally is what I term like an accepted deficiency. It's different from English language literacy. Whereas, you know, people will be embarrassed if you don't quote unquote know how to read. But even with that, that deserves some more examination, because I've come to realize from dealing with math students, when we encounter word problems, that a lot of people that are considered, their level of literacy is not very high, right? Because it's like a lot of people can look at words on a page, they can recognize the syllables and recognize the words, and a lot of the words are sight words, right? So they memorize what they look like. They can read the words per se, but they're not interpreting the information that comes out of the connection of the words in the clauses and in the sentences, and they can't really interpret. And I see that a lot in mathematics, and there's definitely this inextricable link between mathematics and reading that is often overlooked, right? So we gotta really, like, you know, but again, to my other point, how math is like an accepted deficiency, like we mm-hmm. have to, like, math has to stop being an accepted deficiency.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, it's kind of like if you're not good at math, kind of just people just accept it, and, you know, but part of the reason, this is not to, you know, beat up on the people that just accept it. Part of the reason is there aren't as many resources available where somebody can just go and say, all right, well, you know what? I'm not good at this certain topic in mathematics. So let me go, where can I go and, like, really learn how to do this? You know, I was in the car dealership, and I was, you know, they started talking about percentages, and I started to get real anxious, and I didn't know what they were talking about, and, you know, or whatever, you know, and whatnot. So, but I want to learn about percentages. Where can I go and learn about percentages? There's not a lot of places that are inviting and welcoming where you can really go and learn how to calculate percentages and do percentage and practice with percentage word problems. There aren't a lot of places if you're not in school. And even if mm-hmm. you are in school, the schools and the teachers are under certain demands where they may not be able to spend enough time on that topic for you to learn it fully as a child, you know?
Yeah.
But that's another thing we have to address, too, the fact that, like, mathematics is math has to stop being an accepted deficiency, you know? Because, like I said, like, sometimes, like, people almost, like, trauma bond over their math deficiencies.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, okay, we can trauma bond, but let's then try to move forward and try to, like, change our situation. But there have to be resources available, so it's twofold. There has to be resources available for the people to learn what they don't know. And a lot of times, I keep taking it back to all this math. That's what I want all this math to be, a resource so people don't just say, oh, okay, well, when I was in school, when I was in class today, I didn't get it. Teacher tried to teach it, I didn't get it. So it's not like one and done. A lot of us, you know, when you're in school, you're in these situations where you're like one and done. If you don't get it while you're in class that day, then you just ain't going to
mm-hmm.
get it. Because when you go home,
right.
Your parents can't help you, your aunts can't help you, your uncles can't help you. You know, you might have your older siblings can't help you, or you might not have no older siblings. So I want there to be, you know, other resources where it's like, all right, you know what? I didn't know what this teacher was talking about. Something about the way they was breaking it down. Maybe it was a lot going on today. Maybe there was a fire drill in the middle of class, or maybe somebody was, like, getting on my nerves in class and I couldn't really focus. You know, maybe I was hungry, I didn't eat lunch, you know, whatever. All these different types of things could happen, but I might need to just be able to sit in the comfort of my own house and, you know, pull up this YouTube video and, you know, see what this guy is talking about and figure out how to do this homework. And we need more than that. So, you know, it's got to be even just more than just me. I want to create a kind of like a network of educators, because that also helps, you know, we're talking about nation building. We're going to need
business.
No, one of the things that I learned from, you know, studying the lectures of Dr. Clark, you mentioned Dr. Clark earlier, is he was talking, one of the things he talked about Japan. And he talked about Japan a lot, and not in a way to, like, you know, he wasn't like a fan of Japan, but, you know, in terms of just doing his own analysis, he realized, like, why Japan became such a strong country after World War II, because after World War II, when they got, you know, demolished because they was down with, you know, Italy and Hitler and Germany and all them, they closed ranks. And then they said, you know what, you know, as a collective, we need this many oceanographers. We need this many
mm-hmm.
marine biologists. We need this many mathematicians. We need this many computer scientists. And it was about, again, it was about, you know, what is the collective need? Not
mm-hmm.
not what do you need, not what do you want to do as an individual, Like, it's not about what you want. It's about the collective. The collective is first, you know, not that, you know, the individualism has its place, but the collective is primary. And that's why they were able to become, they were able to bounce back. And then, you know, you got, you fast forward like 20 years later, 30 years later, now they're producing cars that are outselling, you know, Fords, Chevys, United States of America, you know, in the 1980s. So people start buying Hondas, Toyotas, Nissans. What is all that? People, children are playing PlayStations right now somewhere, right? So all that's that is Sony. Again, that's Japan. That's because of what they were able to do. They were able to close ranks and say, listen, this is what we need. This is what we need as a collective. So we're going to need mathematics in order to achieve the goals that we have. So the people, we're going to have to train them young, early and often, like they say about voting. Vote early and vote often. That's what they say. We're going to have to train our children early and often. And that's another important part, too, because a lot of it is just about how much time have you put in? How much time have you put in? How many hours? And, you know, when you get it earlier, you know, earlier than later, you know, you're better off. You know, it's just like with tutoring. I was having a conversation with my students about the fact that a lot of them feel that they do poorly in math. They feel they're not good at math, quote unquote, because of who they're comparing themselves to. But they don't know. Mm-hmm. Like, they don't know. You might be in a ninth grade out of the one class, and you're comparing yourself to a classmate, and the classmate kind of just sees the work on the board, just does it, you know, gets 198s on the tests and quizzes and whatnot. But you don't know, like, that student was went to an accelerated middle school where they were doing, like, a lot of, you know, they were already doing algebra one, basically. He's been basically doing this since the sixth grade. So he's had a three-year head start. Your middle school didn't provide you with that for whatever reason. You're seeing this for the first time. So, and then you start thinking, like, oh, well, I can't do it because he already knows how to do it. So I'm thinking that he's just naturally smarter than me. So therefore, I can't do it. So I just give up. But it's not really that. It just means you're going to have to work harder to catch up, you know? But I think a lot of us, we have to start, you know, I mean, I started, you know, my own children on certain things, you know, what I would consider early, but with each successive child, I've started earlier because I realized that, wait, I know I could have started him earlier, you know, because then they get more time. They get more time in, you know. And then there's, like, you know, different things that you can just do, like around the house or in your daily travels and just, you know, riding in the car, you know, just mathematical things, just to make math just a part of their everyday existence.
Right.
And I think that helps children. Like, one of the things I do with my daughter is I want to teach her about percentages. She's in the third grade. And I want to teach her about percentages. So we do this thing where I ask her about random numbers. Like, give me 10% of any random number. And I already taught her that to find 10% of any number, you just identify in your mind, where's the decimal point at? Wherever the decimal point is, the 10%, you just slide the decimal point one space to the left. Because that's basically like dividing by 10, you know, dividing it into 10 equal pieces, you know.
Right.
That, and the value of that is, even if you don't have a calculator, if you can do some mental math, right, if you know how to find 10%. Because if you want to find, let's say, 14% of any number, you can find 10% of the number, right, slide the decimal point over. And then you can find 1% of the number by sliding the decimal point over one more time. And then you say, okay, well, it's 10% and 4%. Well, how's that 1% going to help me? Well, 1 times 4 is 4. So all you got to do is take that 1%, whatever that is, multiply that amount of money times 4, and then add it to whatever the 10% was. So now you know
14%. And I think that's critical in teaching anything, is making it relevant. I think a lot of our children struggle with that, with math and reading, because they're like, well, what difference is it going to make in my life? But we do have two callers, but I'm going to take the caller with the last four, 4983. 4983, you're on.
Peace and blessings, everyone.
Greetings.
This is Camila.
Hi, how are you
doing? And I wanted to. Hi, I'm well.
Great.
It was pretty much just touched on when you mentioned making sure that math is a part of, you know, the everyday life of our children's everyday life. And this is a beautiful discussion. I'm speaking my profession. I own a speech language therapy business. So that's my profession. So I contract to a lot of school districts, and I specifically target school districts from California, Texas, New Mexico, several places. And I specifically contract with districts where, you know, the socioeconomic status is in a place where it's typically more Africans and black people there for, you know, the reasons that are obvious. But in working with those students, a lot of the times I notice that they're frustrated, they're angry. And speaking from a linguistic point, you have to be able to, especially our children, the language at home is totally different than it is in school. Thankfully, within the field of speech therapy, and I got in the field because it is a white woman-dominated field, and there wasn't enough representation. And our children at the time were being, this is 11 years ago, they were being, you know, and still are, you know, just labeled as special education, all these, just so much, especially our black boys. So in working in those, with those places and seeing the frustration, you know, of the children, especially the boys, it was more or less because it was comprehension, and math is comprehension as well. But they couldn't, the language the teacher was using wasn't the language that they heard at home. So for a lot of my, and I mean, I have some, let me tell you, that weren't even going to graduate, because I do K through 12, all levels. Some that weren't going to graduate but were playing football, were playing another sport, but couldn't, you know, comprehend. And, you know, they would say that same thing. Well, I can count my money. My mama said, I just got to count my money. And if I go pro, I got to count my money. I got to count my, you know, that was all, that's always the thing. I got to count my money. But you got to do so much more than that. You know, like you said, word problems. Yeah, it's a major part of math. And just to commend you, Brother Kill, when I was in school, I had horrible math teachers until I got to middle school. And I had a Mr. Barnes, black man. And he was serious. he was a serious man, and he didn't play about math, but he taught it in a way that was common sense. He taught it in a way that was language that I heard at home. It never really came for me before then. I just wanted to do the basics. I love spelling, reading, you know, stuff like that I love. But when it came to math, I was like, oh, because math is so absolute. You know, some of us are just more abstract by nature. So I commend you for what you're doing. I watched a few of your YouTube videos, brother. I commend you. And, of course, I commend the Black Liberation Movement for, you know, just having this platform discussion, because it is so important. It is so important. Math is crucial in so many ways.
Yes, yes. Thank you, sister, for calling in, because what you said is exactly important. And I want to take this next caller, but I want to come back to something she said about speaking the language. But we have another caller, 0363, last four, 0363.
Hey, Sister Crystal, Brother Akira, how y'all doing? This is Eric Riles.
How you doing?
I'm doing well. Good to speak with y'all. Y'all having a good show. I'm definitely enjoying the dialogue. And just to piggyback on what the sister was saying, this math is very important. And I do remember at a young age, there was a lot of the talk as far as, like, amongst me and my friends as far as with math, like, you know, just counting money. So I think with that, it really just limits you to the basics, just adding, subtracting, you know, maybe multiplying and division. And especially at that age, you really don't know how far math can take you once you get into, I guess, some of the more advanced math courses. You know, it branches off into so many different fields that do pay a lot of money. And we don't realize that, and we just stick to the basics. So one question I had was just, you know, with raising children, I'm not going to lie, you know, once I got out of high school, I was straight into the workforce. A lot of what I did learn in school, especially with math, I forgot. I would have to go back and try to reteach myself a lot of things. But with the kids growing up, how can you really gauge what's a good time to introduce them to maybe more advanced things, kind of speaking to what Brother Akil was saying. At a lot of these public schools, they don't push them along as fast. They don't really challenge them in a way that maybe private schools or charter schools might push the kids. Like, for example, I remember when I grew up in Joliet, Illinois, and especially like when my brother went to high school, I just noticed how every day he would come home with a backpack full of homework. And when we moved to Memphis, he would just talk about how it was so easy because they never got homework. So, I mean, what's like, how can you gauge, I know it's probably a case-by-case thing, but, and this might be a hard question to answer, but how can you gauge what would be a good time to introduce your kid to, you know, algebra, you know, maybe before the school does?
So I would do, yeah, I appreciate your question. I think a lot of times it should be like a natural progression based on what they were previously doing. I think, too, like algebra, like I think one of the things I'm very adamant about is introducing algebra as early as possible. Like we can introduce algebra in like when the child is in the age where they would normally be in like first or second grade. We okay. can do that. And when people hear that, they okay. might say, oh, that's crazy. How are you going to do that? Like you just do it, you know. And I have my own children that are living proof of that. And that kind of, so again, that was some documented evidence that there is a, I don't want to use the word conspiracy, but there is a, again, there's a plan. There's not, in certain spaces, children are being molded and socialized to either be able to do certain things or not be able to do certain things. Because I'm sitting here,
right.
you know, my son was like, you know, maybe in first or second grade, and I made it a point. I said, okay, I'm going to teach you how to solve simple equations, right? I'm going to start this early. That's not on his curriculum at school. He was. They went to, you know, a typical, you know, public school here in, you know, Philadelphia. His mother's an educator also, and she taught at the school. So it wasn't like a, you know, very academically challenging school, but, you know, it was more of a safety issue. You know, she had a comfort level. He was in the same building as her. I had a comfort level. I was comfortable with the fact mm-hmm. that he was, so you know that's why he was there. But anyway, I'm teaching him. You know, we're in the house, and I'm teaching him. You know, algebra, and then he understands
okay.
it. He's internalizing it, and then I'm like, okay, but in his classroom, he's not being taught that. And then, and another thing too is, I don't believe that my son is this like you know natural born child prodigy, and that's why he was able to get it. I think all his classmates could have got it too. But they're not being taught that. It's not even on the curriculum.
Right.
So there's not even a goal for first grade, second grade, for second, and he's probably maybe second grade, maybe second grade black boys and black girls in North Philly to learn that. I don't think that that's coincidental at all. So what that says to us is, you know, we have to, again, we have to take the responsibility out of the hands of the schools. And we have to become the primary educators. Now, what does that really look like, though? So I think we need to, you know, research and find, like, our own curriculums. And there are a lot of curriculums mm-hmm. out there, right? So we find our own curriculums, and we just, you know, decide. And again, like, you know, it's a marathon. It's not a sprint. And as parents, you're not going to do everything right at first. But that's okay. It's just like parenting. Teaching is just like parenting, right? And a lot of times when you're quote unquote doing things wrong, when you mess up, you're not really messing up. You're just learning how it doesn't work with that particular
right.
child. And the mm-hmm. next child, that method might work perfectly with the next child. But then there's like that child's, you know, individual personality, and then there's environmental issues. There's just a lot of different factors that play a part. So, you know, just, you know, make the commitment. Don't be so hard on yourself. Make the commitment to try to, you know, teach on your own, find some type of curriculum, and just, you know, just go slow with it. You know, one thing I do say is, like, you know, start out with the multiplication table. You know, when the child is 5 or 6 years old, have them fill in blank multiplication table templates. And this can all, you can also
okay.
use the calculator. Don't expect them to memorize all the multiplication facts. I mean, go from, like, you know, 1 times 1 up to 12 times 12, the old standard multiplication table that's in the back of a marble notebook. right, to this day.
Mm-hmm.
Have them fill that in. You know, you might even make a project out of it, draw a poster, you know, and then so that when y'all have completed it, they can put it on their wall, and they look at it every single day.
Right.
You know.
You see, that's
like
good right there because
but
I was going to say, like, my daughter, she's – now, go ahead, my bad.
No, go ahead.
Now, I was just saying, like that idea that you just gave, because I was going to ask you, like, what are some of the ways that, you know, especially with young kids, that you can keep them engaged? But you kind of just answered that question, like, because my daughter, she loves making projects and stuff like that. So, like, to get a poster board and actually make out a project doing the numbers instead of just writing it on a piece of paper, I think that definitely would engage her more, you know.
Yeah. And then, like, you know, let her – this is what I did with my team years ago. I had him – when we did one, this is probably around maybe 10, 11 years ago, I just gave him the calculator, and I told him what buttons to push. And I was like, bro, I need you to tell me what 4 times 4 is. So you push 4, then you hit the X. That's the multiplication button. You hit 4 again, then you hit the equal sign. Those two lines right there, that's the equal sign. So and at the same time, I was trying to be intentional. I was teaching them how to use the calculator. Because we take that for granted. Especially math teachers, we take that for granted. But a lot of people don't know how to use the calculator because they've never really had to. You know, especially when you talk about a scientific calculator, like how do you square a number? How do you use that? I want to know what 9 squared is. How do you use that on a calculator? What does the button look like? How do you take the square root of a number? What does that button look like? So that's something else that we can do. We can teach our children how to use a scientific calculator and just, like, incorporate it into their, you know, their daily life. Another thing I'll put out there is when I'm driving with my daughter, what I would do with her is you know, let's say it's like 7:48. You know, I just randomly ask her, like, you know, Asada, how long until it's 8 o'clock? You know, those little mathematical computations, but done on a regular basis, it really sharpens ability. And it might seem insignificant, but when you do it on a consistent basis, and there's so many little, I guess people call them hacks, like math hacks, right? That you'll come up with on your own. Once you start thinking like that, you start looking for them. Like even if you're cooking, you know, you got to get the measuring cup out. You know, how much is this?
Yeah.
Well, we half a cup of that. Okay. Fractions are great. Fractions. I remember y'all are taking me back now. Fractions.
Man,
are great.
I hated fractions.
every time me and my young boy Nassim, when he was a youngin, we would order pizza, and I taught him fractions with pizza. And I said, okay, this is already cut up. It's cut up into 8 slices. I'm about to take 1 slice and give it to you. You just took 1/8 of the pizza. 1/8 of the pizza is gone. Now I'm going to take 1 slice.
I got you.
That's 2 slices. That's 2/8 of the pizza.
Yeah.
At the same time, that piece, that's 1/4 at the same time. Because, you know, you can subtract 1/4. So that's a quarter, right? Also, on the multiplication table, we typically look at the multiplication table as just numbers, but we can also look at it as fractions. Because if you look at, on the left-hand side, that column, it's got the numbers going from 0 down to 12, possibly. So if you got, like, look at, like, where the 3 and the 4 is. So that's look at that as 3/4. If you scan across to the right, they're all equivalent fractions. So it goes from 3/4, then what is it, 6/8. Then it's 9/12, and so on and so forth. You know, so those are all equivalent fractions. So yeah, it's a lot of little
differences. I got you.
But the key is just make it like because what we do because again because of the way math is marketed to us, it's not our fault. It's not our fault initially. Math is marketed to us as something like, listen, this ain't for y'all. Stay away from this.
Right.
This is not for y'all. You know, I remember I was in high school, 12th grade, I worked at Little Caesars Pizza. And, you know, one day I just started working. I worked there for like maybe a month or so. I asked the assistant manager, I said, listen, can I get on the register? And he was like, nah, it's not for you. He was a cool brother. He was a cool brother. I don't think he meant no harm, but I still remember that. And I still remember thinking about that years later. Like, that's a way to limit a person's growth and development, is that you
right.
don't give them the opportunity to do certain things. So math has been, the way mathematics is marketed to us is that we shouldn't even want to do it. You know, it's not for us. It's for them. Math is for them smart people. You know, we don't talk about math in this house, like not explicitly at least. We do, that's kind of like one of the tragedies of all this. We do math all the time. We don't even know it. We're doing
right.
it all the time.
Right.
But it's the language piece. It's the language barrier because the way it's expressed to us in the classroom does not coincide with what we're actually doing in our households, in our neighborhoods, on our blocks, in our hoods on a regular basis. It doesn't coincide and match up. That's more of a language issue, you know, because math is a language in and of itself, you know. So because I realized that when, again, back to the word problems, a lot of people have issues with word problems. But a lot of my students over the years that have had issues with word problems, once we translate the word problem into the equation, they have many of them had no problem with solving the equation. They could solve the equation. They understood the technical aspects of algebra. They could solve the equation with no problem, but they can't translate it from, you know, from the word problem to the equation. So it's kind of like, you know, if we start looking at math in terms of a language that needs to be translated, then, you know, we probably would make some even more progress, you know?
When Sister Camilla was talking about, you know, her math teachers were speaking a different language, and the words that they were using weren't words that we use every day, and that's so important, because we have to understand that a lot of times that's why we don't do as well on these standardized tests, because the language in those tests is not the language that we speak every day amongst ourselves. You know, I remember when I was in library school, I did a whole paper on the language of African American homes, black homes, as opposed to, you know, the double consciousness that W.E.B. Du Bois speaks on, how we have to be one way in our environment and another way in that environment. And it's a struggle all the time for us.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go in and you have this whole different cultural language that you had to decipher and translate, and then you have to get to the problem. So, you know, or that's why, you know, Brother Kiel, when you teach and you incorporate, you know, ancestors or African concepts into your lesson, I think that's great for our students to experience.
Yeah. Well, let me say another thing to you, brother. I know you mentioned that you said after high school you forgot most of the stuff. But listen, that's another thing.
Mm-hmm.
Don't feel bad about that. Math teachers forget stuff too. Like if I have to,
okay.
You know, if I didn't teach like geometry in like 3 years or 2 years, and then, you know, I might not remember. Like right now as we speak, I may not be able to tell you all the different triangle congruence postulates. I'm familiar with them, but I might not be able to run them off the top of my head right now, but I can look them up and I can go find them.
I got you.
So the thing is, like, we all forget, no matter what level we're at, we all forget, you know, because it's so much mathematics out there, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right.
Aspects of statistics, Z-scores, like, oh, how do you do that again? I know how to do it, but I don't really, I got to go hit my notes up, right?
Mm-hmm.
So even is the people that are the seen as the authorities and the experts, the subject matter experts, we forget too. So, like, no parent, you know, listening to this should feel like, you know, if you forget, you know, you forgot or whatever. Like, yeah, you know, it's use it or lose it. You know, that's like with a lot of things.
Right.
Other things.
Now, I appreciate that, bro, because I was kind of embarrassed. I appreciate that.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, don't be embarrassed at all.
Sure.
You know, another thing that I want to express on this program, because this speaks to us becoming more independent and feeling confident that we can teach our own children, is that,
mm-hmm.
again, marketing. There's this kind of idea around the profession of education. And it is a noble profession, and I am a teacher, and I say this as a teacher. that there are a lot of teachers that, for lack of a better term, like the sister said, they're not very good. They're not very good. So what that actually should do is be motivational for us, because a lot of times we think, oh, well, you know, I don't have an education degree. I didn't go to college.
Yeah.
I don't know what Bloom's taxonomy. I don't know all the teacher lingo and all this and that. I don't know all of that. I don't know all the language. When we went to back to school night and the teacher was talking to us about, Malik's performance in class, I didn't know some of the language and the terminology that the sister was using or whatever. We shouldn't let that discourage us, because a lot of these teachers don't know what they're doing either. To the parents, as a parent, if you haven't been, you haven't been trained, then you don't know. It's kind of like the sports. Anybody that, plays basketball every day and has played basketball, you can look at somebody and tell if they're a good ball player. But somebody that don't play basketball and don't watch basketball, somebody might really not be that good, but they might be able to fake it. Because you don't know. Because you don't know no better. Because you haven't studied that and analyzed that sport. So teaching is very similar. Like there are a lot of teachers that, just aren't that good. And they need support. This is not about, I'm not trying to beat up teachers, but I'm just speaking of reality. And I want to expose that, because I don't think that gets said enough. Because I think that's one of the things that hinders us from thinking that we can't do as good of a job, if not better, than the people that have the degrees or that are in the classrooms, because we feel like, mm-hmm. I have to send my children to them because they're the trained professionals. And, yes, they might be a trained professional, but they may not be a subject matter expert. Because that takes time. It takes time to become a subject matter expert. That doesn't happen like freshman
right.
college. Your first year. I had some elders, some consultants that worked with us in the first school I ever taught at, where the first full time position I ever got. And she told me and my homeboy this. She said, "Listen," she said, "you're not even going to start to know what you're doing until you're at least 5 years in."
Hmm.
And I said, "Oh." And she was,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He was right. She was right. I didn't even really start to know what I was doing until 5 years, until probably around 4 or 5 years in.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we have about 22 minutes left. Thank you, Brother Eric, for calling in. Appreciate your questions. It added to a great conversation. Brother Keel, I would like for you to give out your information again, and just tell people how they can contact you if they have any questions, what it is that you're doing right now. I know we introduced you at the beginning of the show, but just talk to us a little bit about all this math and how they can ask questions and all that.
Okay, so All This Math primarily is an online, and we've been online since the pandemic started. But prior to the pandemic, I did some face-to-face tutoring. It's primarily a private math tutoring company. I also do some educational consulting for schools and school districts. I've done a little bit of that. I'd like to do more as we move forward. And also one of the projects that I'm dedicating a lot of energy to right now, because I realize like there aren't enough hours in the day for me to tutor everybody that needs tutoring, is building up this YouTube channel, providing the video breakdowns of different problems. So I'm attempting to build up the YouTube channel. The YouTube channel is, you can go to www.youtube.com. But you got to put in after the youtube.com/lowercase c, another /, and then All This Math. So that will take you directly to the All This Math YouTube channel. I'm adding content on a regular basis. I haven't added any content in the past 2 weeks, I want to say.
I've been recording the videos in my office at Cheney, and I haven't been at Cheney because the semester just ended. So that's what I'm really pushing. So I'm actually going to be on a lot of different programs in the spring and throughout the summer, really trying to push the YouTube channel because it is a solution to one of our problems. Like, one of our problems is that collectively many of us do not have the understanding of mathematics, and we have some blind spots in our mathematical understanding. So what I'm trying to do is fill in those blind spots. So that's why the YouTube channel is there. I want people to take advantage of it. I want people to use it. I want people to subscribe to it. I want people to share the videos. I want the YouTube channel really to go viral. I know right now in a lot of school districts across the country and probably beyond the country, I know Khan Academy is seen as the standard for mathematics videos. And Khan Academy has some value. But at the same time, Khan Academy is not culturally relevant to us. And I think we need whatever any group of people does, it should be culturally relevant to them, no matter who the group of people is, right? So my videos are culturally relevant. You get a lot of, you know, what you would get if you were, you know, in my class. And, you know, my students from the past 16 years can attest to that. I have former students that, you know, have subscribed to the channel. And they've used it for help with that, with the homework for their children. You know, so that's really a beautiful, beautiful thing. You know, it's like Marimba Ani, like the circle be unbroken. You know, it's intergenerational thing that we're doing. So I really want this to become a popular resource that, you know, everybody knows about, and people feel like, oh, okay, well, you know, if I don't understand in class, I have another option, another opportunity. You know, I don't have to just concede defeat and loss and just say, okay, well, I'm just going to fail this class. Go to All This Math, and there will be videos. And again, I'm adding different. Most of my content right now is in Algebra 1 and Geometry. There's some pre-algebra, and I will be adding a lot of content through the summer, building up. I have probably about 100 videos up now.
It's good.
But even when I get into like editing and everything, some of the older videos are going to come down and be replaced. And some of the videos I just may take the same examples and just redo them. Because a lot of it was me just kind of experimenting and just, like when the pandemic first started, that's when I started recording. And I was recording right here in my house in my den. And, you know, I kind of just started out and I was just, you know, just trying some things out. And, you know, some of those videos might get replaced, but I'll work out the same exact problems, you know.
Okay.
So that's really trying to promote the most is the YouTube channel. So, you know, people can have an outlet and they can say, okay, well, you know, I do have a way to understand mathematics better, you know. And also going forward, what I want to, and again, because it's all culturally relevant, what I'm going to start doing as well is having different segments with different, you know, people from the Black community that are, you know, involved in certain careers and involved in certain entrepreneurial activities. So, you know, we can talk about, you know, mathematics in the context of whatever they do, because that question that students often ask, which is a valid question but annoys the hell out of a lot of teachers when we don't have good answers for the question, is when am I ever going to use this stuff?
Right.
So what I want to do in order to, you know, provide some answers is have a plethora – I like that word, plethora, by the way – but have a plethora – videos with brothers and sisters from the community, from the Black collective, that, you know, are in this business or in that business, or, you know, work this type of job or work that type of job, and I handcraft my own short math problems that are directly connected and linked to the work that they do. So our young people can see that, and then not only the young people, but, you know, parents at home. Then they can be, you know, hopefully that a light bulb will go off and just say, okay, so I never thought about math that way. So when we're in the house, you know, we can have, you know, I can point out some ways in which we're using math all the time, and I didn't even think about that. You know, I mean, think about how much math goes into. I mean, somebody's trying to do a fundraiser and they're doing a fish fry. That's a lot of math that goes into that. We take it for granted. But that's a whole lot of math. It's a whole lot of math. Because everything costs money. The fish costs money. The styrofoam platters cost money. You know, everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the ingredients for the baked macaroni and cheese, if you make that, the greens, whatever. Whatever you make, everything.
Mm-hmm.
Then you got to consider, okay, well, I know what my financial goal is, so how much, and these are all mathematical questions we have to ask ourselves. Like, I know what my target amount of money is, so I know how much all my ingredients cost, my cost of goods. I know how much money I need to end up with, so what do I need to charge for each platter, and how many platters do I need to sell? That's all algebra, even if we don't think of it like that. It's all algebra.
Yep. And, you know, you and I talked about
been doing that for years. The same,
right.
And the same black people
right.
will say, oh, never good at math. It's like, sis, you good at math. You just don't know it.
Right.
You know,
you and I talked about, we talked about incorporating some type of math program in the agriculture program. You know, we have, you know, this, 3-foot row, and we need to space our plants to, you know, whatever part, how many plants can we fit on a row, things of that nature, how we can use math in what we're doing in our everyday life. But we only have a few minutes left, so I wanted to ask Brother Patrick to come back on and close us out. I think it has been a robust and fruitful conversation, and I really thank the caller for calling in and adding to it.
Briefly about histomatics? So I don't want to take up too much of the time. But another thing that I'm going to be doing more work with, and I have been doing work with, is the concept of histomatics. And you can find that on the
mm-hmm.
website, allthismath.com. And you reminded me of that early in the program when you mentioned Fannie Jackson Coppin. Now, Fannie Jackson Coppin is a connection, and kind of, you know, she, along with Octavius Caddo, who she worked with at the Institute for Colored Youth before it became Cheney University years later,
mm-hmm.
where I currently teach. Just knowing that as a professor, knowing that I'm part
mm-hmm.
of that lineage and part of that genealogy is important and it's motivational. And that's one of the things that, you know, we have those conversations in my classes, and the students are all kind of always taken aback, like, why are we talking about this in a math class? And the reason we're talking about it is because we don't have to separate, like, this is part of, like, math has a history. You know, everything,
mm-hmm.
everything has, discipline has a history. So just like, you know, Octavius Caddo was a man that was pretty multidisciplinary. You know, he was a baseball player, he was a math professor, he was a human rights activist. He was instrumental in recruiting brothers to fight for the Union Army in the Civil War. He was on the same stages with Frederick Douglass back in the day. Matter of fact, in his baseball team, the Pythians from Philadelphia, he would go down to D.C. One of Frederick Douglass's sons played on a baseball team in D.C. Charles Douglass, and they would kind of link up and strategize and talk about how to, you know, kind of subvert this system. So that when I learned about that, that made me think about professional sports differently, and how, like, our black athletes historically, even before, like, you know, Muhammad Ali, you know, saying, no, I'm not going to the Vietnam War and all that, we were doing that. We were using sports as kind of like a way to travel and link up and, you know, and strategize, you know, to advance our people. So, and this was Octavius Caddo, who was a, you know, a professor at the Institute for Colored Youth when he used to be in South Philly, which was around the corner from one of the first schools that I ever taught at in Philly. But histomatics is really about that. It's about connecting mathematics, you know, and teaching math problems and talking about people like, you know, historical figures, you know, that were black, that were of African descent, and
mm-hmm.
just making a connection. Because, again, and it's organic because, you know, again, we're trying to solve problems. We're trying to fill the voids and fulfill, correct the deficiencies that our children have. And two major areas that our children have deficiencies in is in the areas of our history and really world history, because our history is part of world history, and mathematics. So we can, you know, we can find ways to, you know, combine the two of them. So that's really what mathematics and Fannie Jackson Coppin
reminds me of that, because that's, you know, that's somebody
right.
that I would talk about, you know, in one of my matters.
That's what's up. Well, Brother Keel, I have enjoyed everything. I've learned a lot, and I'm sure the listening audience did as well. I'm going to go ahead, and I really appreciate you for taking the time, because I know you're in Philly, and I know it's, what, 9:51 there. So thank you for your time and your expertise and your specific skill set, your superpower. Brother Patrick, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to you to close us out.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sister Crystal. And Brother Akil, you still there?
I am.
Okay. But look, I want to speak directly to you, brother. I can remember a lady coming up to me about 4 years ago. And she said, you know what, young man? She said, we had 10,000 of you. Our problem would be over with. I didn't say that to speak anything of myself. I said that to speak something about what people see. Mm-hmm. And I said that because it's relevant for me to say, if we had 10,000 of you, our problems would begin to be eradicated. So I want to thank you, Brother Akil, for making math, first of all, fun, but also making math relevant. I think back to the times when I was in high school, I hated math. I hated math. But when I think about it, our children's struggles in math is a struggle with focus. And I think focus problems are rooted in distraction. And we are people that's inundated, change when our children go to these school systems. I think back on myself in relation to all my peers when I was coming up. I had white teachers that I didn't like looking at. And I wasn't focused. It wasn't fun. It was not relevant to me. So then if I could take the RCA Academy and multiply it by 1,000, if I could take Akil Parker and multiply him by 10,000, I think we'll begin to eradicate our problem. Our children basically see math for them as a link to counting money and their hourly rate wages. That's for the most part. That got to change. And I think from what I'm hearing tonight, if we had Akil Parker multiplied by 10,000, RCA Academy multiplied by 1,000, our children would see more to math than just counting money or hourly wages. I see perplexing problems existing in the conscious community as it pertains to math. I think Imhotep would be proud of you, Brother Akil. I think brothers pontificate a lot. I talk to brothers all the time that have the theory to how our ancestors built pyramids, but it don't translate to an ability to build a doghouse here. And I think you make it relevant. I'm going to say this and I'm going to close out. I had a dream once that I was talking with a group of college, black college civil engineers. And I was introducing to them the concept of black liberation and what it was that we were doing in Mississippi with the Black Liberation Movement. And I asked those civil engineers, I said, let's build black townships. And those civil engineers responded to me and said, why would we want to do that? That's a serious problem. So teaching this math, we also have to teach black love, cultural awareness, so that when we become these professionals that I'm sure you turning out at Taney University, Brother Akil, that these math savants and experts that you're teaching will have a cultural awareness
but if we can produce a practical application and build that nation that you're talking about. And I feel you, and I heard you very clearly. When we're talking about nation building, that's a damn fairy tale. There's no fairy tale, like Shabaka Asker explained clearly to me. He said, Patrick, can you imagine a nation? He said, do we have that type of imagination? Well, it can be taught to us by people like Brother Akil Park. Well, there are children who actually are the key holders to our future. So if we don't do what's necessary, and I'm seeing very clearly, and I'm strengthening my resolve to continue to build the Arshay Academy, to undergird it with the finances that we need so that we can produce the practical, applicated reality, not just the theory. Brothers like Akil Parker got to be forefront, and we have to be able as a people to finance that type operation. So with that being said, that Japan analogy that you made is very real. And the Japanese understand how real it is. And you see them. America had not affected Japan in the way that it had affected black people. Japanese, Chinese are protected by their culture. We have to be the same way. So with that being said, it's been a great show. Sister Crystal, you did a great job in hosting the show. Brother Akil, you was a great guest, brother. And we hope to have you back. You're very effective. You're very effective. And I'm not going to close us out because that's Brother Maurice's job to close us out.
Okay.
But thank you, Brother Akil, for coming on. And I appreciate you, brother.
Problem.
We'll be connected. No
doubt.
Thank you, brother.
Yes, sir. Brother Maurice.
Brother Maurice.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. Excellent program today, Sue. And as we always say, you kill the nigga in you, I'm going to kill the nigga in me, and our God will reign supreme. We are Black First today, tomorrow, and forever. As-salamu alaykum. Shalom. Peace and blessings.
Alaykum salam.
Ashay.
Ashay.
Ashay.